Today's Teisho will be on case 100 in the Book of Serenity. 100 is entitled Longyan's Mountains and Rivers. One introduction. One word can cause a nation to flourish. One word can cause a nation to perish. This drug can kill people and can bring people to life too. The benevolent seeing this call it benevolence. The wise seeing this call it wisdom. But tell me, where does the benefit or harm lie? A monk asked Master Longya Zhao, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Longya said, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Verse, seeing existence without considering it existent, turning the hand over and back, the man on Mount Longya does not fall behind Gautama. So this is the final day of our August Sesshin, our August 2024 Sesshin. And I think it's been a great success, to say the least. You know, people are coming into the Dokusan room, and it's very clear that they're profoundly engaged, and they're really practicing wholeheartedly. Just wonderful. And today, this morning, again, you know, there's three long sits and people are sitting so still. It's really, really quite amazing and wonderful as far as I'm concerned. So this is really this, you know, Sesshin, I believe, is the most amazing invention, right? You know, basically this style of practice, practicing together, sitting across from one another, facing each other, is just so powerful, that collective energy. You know, it's not clear how people practice meditation in ancient India. And there may have been a variety of different ways. You know, in Thailand today, monks practice on their own. You know, they go and meditate in little huts called kuti, typically. They do collective rituals, you know. And in some Tibetan traditions also, this is the case where people practice, they meet with a teacher, they go into their room and they practice and then they come and report to the teacher. This approach that we have might have been invented in China. The idea of sitting together like this is just extraordinary, you know. And you might not on your own get up at 4:30 in the morning to meditate, you know, but you know you're in a situation where everybody's doing that, and so you do it too, right? And then you come and you sit down on the cushion and it's day five of the Sesshin for you, and those three sits in the morning are long sits, you know, and man, you get through that second sit and your legs are really hurting, right? And maybe not even through the second sit, maybe halfway through the second sit, you know, your leg is kind of like screaming at you and you think, you know, I'm just going to move. And it's okay, you know, at that moment, if you're just in agony, uncross your leg quietly and take a breather. But, you know, if you don't do that, you might deepen your concentration even more, right? And one reason you might not move is that you look around and you see nobody else is moving. You know, and you're looking at across the room and you see somebody who's not moving, and you open your eyes and you see that person and you think, well, he's not moving. And so you close your eyes and you think, I'll get through this. I'll go back to... Meanwhile, that other person opens her eyes and sees you and thinks, well, he's not moving, right? And in this way, you know, both people make it through the sit. It's so wonderful, right? And both people get to a point where they think, you know, if I don't do this, I'll scream. And then they suddenly, it's like they go to a deeper level. And the pain becomes less urgent. And it's like entering a deeper samadhi, right? And then the bell rings and it's like, you know, wow, I did it. So that collective process is so wonderful. It's like you're helping everybody in the room with your sitting, and they're helping you, right? And in this way, you know, everybody's practice is deepened. The character of the practice is deepened for everybody. So all of us are working together in this really magical way. It's the power of collective practice, right? So today is today's Taisho is this koan. A monk asked Master Langya Zhao, "Purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth?" Now that question might make absolutely no sense, right? But it's kind of saying, what is purity, and it's also saying, what's the connection between what we think of as purity and everyday life, right? You know, if you're just starting out, if this is your first sesshin, you know, congratulations. We finish at 6 o'clock, right around 6 o'clock, and we still have hours of sitting to go, and we have dokusan and so on. But you know, when you come to sesshin for the first time, you know, you may be thinking, when I just said that, you might think, how many hours? Oh no, you know. It's like you might be thinking, that's a lot of hours still. And, you know, that as we get closer to the end, you may be thinking about what you want to, you know, what you want to eat tomorrow. You know, you can celebrate and have some kind of special food and, you know. But eventually what happens, if you keep coming to sesshin, if you keep practicing daily or, you know, often, is that when you come to sesshin, you're going to be like in this wonderful place, I swear to you. You know, you will, you know, everybody, for everybody, day two is really a difficult day, right? You know, when you come to sesshin, day one is, okay, right? You know, basically you're getting into the groove, you're doing a lot of sitting. You know, day two, you get up in the morning and you think, wow, you know, my legs really hurt. And you go through the day, and as you go through the day, your back starts to hurt, you feel more tired. And then, you know, if you have been able to come for 5 days, you know, on day three, it's often the case, although it can happen earlier and it might happen a little later. On day three, there's like this, it's like a light switch goes on in your head, right? And basically, you know, the evening of day two, it is empirically, my research shows that day two is the day most people are likely to leave, right? So basically, when people generally bail on sesshin, it's usually like the afternoon or evening of day two. and people will just feel totally overwhelmed. And usually I will say to them, look, it's going to get better tomorrow. You know, I promise. But it's, you know, they're at a place where they just, it's like, I'm out of here. And you can hear the tires on the gravel, you know, outside. You know, they're just speeding away. And I understand. And many of the people who have done that, by the way, have come back and become really excellent practitioners. But, you know, if you stay on day three, typically, you know, there's like this light switch goes on. And, you know, it's not like the pain vanishes. But you're in a very different place. You know, people will come into the Dokusan room, and they'll, you know, when I first started doing this, you know, I had finished my training with Glenn Webb Roshi, and I started doing this practice here in New Jersey, and early people I practiced with included Jaru and Jim, and a little later Sandy. And my first sesshin we had at my house in Plainfield, and I had never run a sesshin before. I had been Karma Dana and Jiki Jitsu. I had run sesshins, but I had never, you know, done a sesshin on my own and done Dokusan with my students. So, you know, I had been practicing with my students at the university on a regular basis, and we had this sesshin, and on day one, people were okay. And then the evening of day two, people came in, and it was like, oh my God, this, everything is terrible. You know, I feel so sad, or I feel, you know, I'm just so angry, or I hate this, you know. And it was like, I went to bed that night and I thought, oh my God, I'm a total failure as a Zen teacher. And anyway, you know, the session goes on, the show goes on. So I got up the next day and we went through the day, and then we did Dokusan, and people came in, and I was waiting for them to unload and say, I'm out of here, you know. And instead they said, oh, I'm so happy. I've never, you know, everything is so nice, you know, I feel so energized. You know, I said, oh, I must be a brilliant Zen teacher, you know. But I'm not, you know. It's just the process. You know, I always say, trust the process. You know, if you just hang in here for a while, you do this for a number of times, eventually you will get to this point where the light switch goes on, and it's a different world, right? And you'll just feel so much better. And, you know, there's ups and downs as the session continues. You know, feeling better doesn't mean you've answered your koan or you've finished your koan. You may feel fantastic one day, and the next day, you know, not so fantastic. But there's a qualitative change, right? And eventually, you know, a session is just like this. People who stick with it think of session as like going to this place that's just so restorative and healing, because it is. And then, you know, you begin to have this experience. You know, the first timer thinks, I can't wait till I get home, right? And that was certainly true for me. But the more practiced person thinks, oh no, it's time to go home, see? So you know, eventually it happens to be the case that you know, when you're in sesshin, you go through this transformation, and everything seems, you know, it can actually be the case. I'm not exaggerating. I'm not selling you on anything, right? It can be the case where you just feel like, you know, you walk outside and the grass is alive and the clouds are alive and you feel totally connected. You know, you get in your car and let me just say, I had this experience for about 10 years, right? I would go to sesshin and I'd be in this wonderful place, and then I would drive home and I would get to my job or get to my class, and all this crap would happen, right? And I would think, oh man, if only I were back in sesshin. So there's kind of a divided, you begin to enter sort of like a split world where you can go to this place which is in many ways like incredibly liberating. You know, you find this compassion in yourself, and then you go back to your everyday life, and you know, the first, you know, there's all these challenges, and it seems so, Sesshin seems so far away. And after a couple of weeks, it can feel like your Sesshin mind is gone, right? It's like I'm back in the same old rut. I'll never forget that at the Seattle Zen Center, we used to have our winter Sesshin between Christmas and New Year's. It was the only time everybody could agree on doing Sesshin. So, you know, basically it was like January 26th or something, we would all leave for Sesshin and we would come back like New Year's Eve or something like that. And I went to Sesshin and I was in this very buoyant place and I came back and, you know, basically somebody had broken into our house. You know, actually this is true, it was in Seattle. We used to live near the Quaker Center and we had this little house and we went out, I came back from Sesshin, I had a nap and then let's go out to a movie. We went up to Capitol Hill and saw a movie, and when we came back, somebody had like taken the whole back door off, like the whole door frame was taken off, right? And because we came home and our cat was outside. And Barbara said, well, I thought we put him in, Moon in the house. And I said, I did. You know, how did he get out? And then we walked around and back. It's just like, oh, back, you know, we're back. And so that kind of split screen experience can happen. And you could say, you might ask yourself, you know, what is it about Sesshin that, you know, transforms the world, right? What is it? What's the secret sauce of Sesshin, right? You could try to duplicate the Sesshin experience at home. You know, you might start getting up at 4:30 in the morning, or 5, something I've done for a long time. You might do more zazen during the day. You might switch over to a vegan diet like we have here and make dal for dinner every night and brown rice, and you can buy some pickles at the store, right, at the Asian store. You can do all of that. That might be a misunderstanding of what's so liberating about this, right? Lots of people, this is a lovely place to do Sesshin. There's absolutely nothing, it's a magical place. And why it's a magical place, we ought to think about. But there are, if you go to many Zen places, they're very different from this. So for a while I trained at a place called Daibo Satsu Zendo in Livingston Manor, New York. After I got out here, I didn't have a community, so I went up there. And if you go up there, they're on this huge piece of property. It's in Sullivan County in the Catskills. And you turn off the main road and it says Daibo Satsu Zendo. You drive and you drive and you drive, and finally you get to this lake, this mountain lake, and there's this temple that looks like it was dropped out of the sky in Japan, right? And it's just like, it's got central heating, which Japanese temples don't have, and so on. But it's just this beautiful, beautiful building. And it has all of these lovely features. It cost, the teacher at this place had a little apartment originally when he came from Japan in Manhattan. And he basically put a little ad in the Village Voice, and it said, meditation classes in, you know, Manhattan, go to this place, this address. And, you know, who should walk into his little apartment but the president of the 3M Corporation and his wife. And they became his sponsors. They became his sponsors, and they gave him like this ton of money for this beautiful place. I've definitely had people who, this place looks quite a bit nicer than it used to. When we started doing Sesshin here, I would say this place really looked a bit like a derelict building, you know. It needed to paint and so on. The windows would just rattle in the wind, right? And you, if you sat next to the windows, you got the cold air, you know, it was like that. Anyway, I've had people come here and actually never come back. There was a woman who was sitting here, she came for one session, and I saw her once, and I said, you ever thinking of coming back to have Sesshin again? And she said, oh, no, I practice at Kripalu. Kripalu is this yoga center, and it's like staying in a three-star hotel, right? It's just beautiful, right? A beautiful place. And it's possible to think that the magic of going up to a place like Daibu Sato Zenda, what's so liberating is that architecture, you know, the Japanese architecture, which is beautiful, right? And everybody wears robes up there. Even the you know, lay people wear robes. And when you get home, you can buy a furoshiki and hang it in the window, or you can, you know, get some calligraphy and mount it on the wall. And I have a lot of calligraphy on my wall, right? But, you know, actually, those things are not the secret sauce, right? That's a mistaken view, in my opinion, right? Having a building that looks like a Japanese temple does not guarantee that liberation happens inside, right? And, this building that we're in at one time looked a bit like a derelict building, but many breakthroughs happened in that derelict building. So the secret sauce isn't the beautiful appointments of the building. It's not the location. You know, when I first explored this place as a Sesshin venue, it was relatively remote, but now, you know, if I need a mop and I can't get it at the grocery store, I'll just go to Target next door. I'll go to, you know, Kmart, or I mean to a Walmart and get a mop. You know, it's so convenient. Walmart's right next door. If you say to somebody, where do you practice? We say, oh, it's next to the Walmart. And you might think, oh, no, you know, some people might think, oh, no thanks, I'm going to Kripalu, right? But you know, that's really, they're really missing the point, really missing the point. One of the beautiful things about this koan is, you know, the fact that the monk asked a question of Master Langyan Zhao. He says, purity is originally so. So there's purity. How does purity come from, or how does purity square with, or where does purity come from in this world of mountains, rivers, and the great, great earth, you know? And the teacher just repeats the whole statement. He just says the same thing again. So the student asks a question and the teacher says the same thing. So we might say, well, wait, what's the difference? What's the difference, see? One person can come here and, you know, leave on day two and say, well, that place, you know, nothing happening there, right? And another person could say, this is like a Bodhi Mandala, This is a bodhimandala in Buddhist, in the Buddhist way of thinking, is a space where liberation happens. Like a, this, I think Murray Grove is a bodhimandala. People have had many encounters with enlightened mind in this place, right? So somebody might come and say, no, no thanks. And somebody else might say, this is sacred ground, right? Next to Kmart. And you can say, what's the difference? And it's not just subjective taste, right? They're going to the same place, but they're not having the same experience. And that's true for many things. Like, you know, you can go to, you know, one of the things that Tibetan Buddhists do all the time is have these sand paintings, right? They'll have a pub, they'll go to like the Met and they'll set up shop and do a sand painting and everybody comes and they're very nice, right? And one person looks at the sand painting and just feels like totally set free. And another person looks at the sand painting and says, yeah, that's interesting. You know, what's for lunch, right? And what's the difference? What's the difference? You know? So this koan is really saying, you know, when we think that the secret sauce is the location, or the secret sauce is the aesthetics, or we think the secret sauce is, you know, this or that, we're looking at the world and not our relationship to the world. You know, it's like... we're looking at the world and not our relationship to the world. Our relationship to the world is the secret sauce, right? So it does. You can own a Zen. You can go online and get a Zen robe for your home, and you can get the incense. But that's not what makes. That's not the secret sauce, right? So what's the secret sauce? What is it that takes a world that is impure, and turns it into a pure land? What is it? What's the transformation that has to happen, right? And is it in the sutras? You know, we're reading the sutras. We can pore over the sutras, but it's not in the sutras either, actually. You know, it's in our relationship to things around us. And what is it that changes? Right. What is it that changes on day 3 of Sesshin for so many people? Right? And that's the secret sauce, right? So one clue that I could give you is, you know, when you sit down on the cushion and you watch the breath, and you begin to experience this state we call samadhi. You know, it can be very shallow, relatively shallow, but can be increasingly deep. And you might experience samadhi in various ways. You know, some people when they enter samadhi, they feel like they're disappearing. I myself, when I'm in deep samadhi, I feel like my whole body has disappeared except for my hands and my face, you know. And some people, when they're in samadhi, they feel, you know, like they're made of stone. And, you know, different people have different experiences of deep samadhi, but there's a somatic dimension. So when you go into deep samadhi, you know, and then you maybe go into emptiness. And then the bell rings and we have a little break and you go out into the back yard there, or you go walking in the nature trail. Everything seems so alive, right? Everything seems so alive. And you might say as I do, oh my God, samadhi is this wonderful thing, right? And you could maybe answer the question here by saying, well, the difference is samadhi, and that would be true. It's like, what takes the impure world and turns it into a pure land. And one way to answer this koan would be to say samadhi, samadhi. Another way would be to say, to turn it around and say something like this. When the world is pure, what is not there, right? When the world is pure, what is not there? And I would, a deeply enlightened person said to me, what's not there is me. See? Me. So, you know, as long as we're referencing ourselves, as long as it's all about me, see, all about me, that is the world of that's the world of desire. And that's a burning house and will never be satisfactory. And, you know, the minute we forget the self, the minute we stop being in the self and we're just one with the world around us, it turns into a pure land. That's the secret sauce. It takes a little work, right? I would say most people take about 3 days of practice. And they begin to, you know, to forget the self. The great Master Dogen said, to practice Zen is to study the self, right? Sit on the cushion, look at your mind. To study the self, he said, is to forget the self. That's day 3 of Sesshin. And then he said, to forget the self is to become one with the mountains, the rivers, and the great earth. Right. So, samadhi, forgetting the self, this is what restores the world to wholeness. It restores us to wholeness. But the thing in the way is the self. And the minute it disappears, this becomes our pure land. A monk asked Master Langya Zhao, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? Langya said, purity is originally so. How does it suddenly produce mountains, rivers, and the great earth? See, any answer he gave him, there's no difference except in your consciousness. There's no difference except in your relationship to the world. The world can be hell or the world can be a pure land. The wish-fulfilling jewel is forgetting the self. So, you know, you're all doing a wonderful job, much forgetting of the self here. We're purifying body, mind, and heart together. And it's wonderful. Thank you.